feel like just messing around. Do you mind if I just mess around tonight? That's just the way I feel. I mean, you know, messing around night. You ever have the feeling that 90% of your life is just messing around? What do you think you're doing right now, Nick? Horsing around, huh? No, I'm afraid that when you're working, that is another category. But I spend a lot of time, I'm afraid, horsing around. The one thing I've noticed about these guys in Watergate, they're all such official-looking people. They wear ties and suits, and they keep diaries, very involved, intricate diaries of telephone calls and meetings and transcripts and stuff like that. Now, that's a totally alien life to the life that most of us live. And you have to whip out a diary. Have you ever kept a diary at all? Have you? Not even when you were a little kid? You mean you didn't get the urge that one day you're... Jerry, did you? No? Well, I did. I must admit that I did keep a diary once, and it came about this way. Let's face one thing for starters. I was not the literary type kid, but I did have one thing happen one time. I was in the Army at the time, and for one reason or another, I was in the tent of the chaplain, and it had nothing to do with a religious matter. As a matter of fact, I was sent there on a detail. Me and three other guys were going to clean out the tent. So I'm there with these other two PFCs and messing around in the tent there. And the chaplain is talking to a first lieutenant. Now, the chaplain is a captain. And he's talking to a first lieutenant. And they got this desk in there. And they have a little... Did you know that the Army has even portable altars? It has a folding organ that they can take and set up on the field. The whole business. See, so I'm in there cleaning up the tent. And the chaplain is saying to the first lieutenant, he says, I'd like to go with you, Russ, or words to that effect, down to the officers' club tent. I'd like to go with you, but I have to finish up some work on my diary here. And with that, Russ says, well, okay, Padre, I'll see you down there when you get through, and I'll keep some beer cold for you. And he leaves. At which point the chaplain sits down and he opens up this book and he starts to write. He is writing a diary. Well, I couldn't help it. I asked him, I said, what are you writing a diary for, chaplain, may I ask? He says, well, he said, you know, someday this may be a valuable document, but people will want to know what it was really like to be in the Army. And I'm keeping a diary for that, for posterity. He actually said that to me. So I said, gee, I'm messing around. Here I am doing all this great stuff, you know, like cleaning out the tent. And I cleaned out the latrine last night. And probably won't even remember that stuff 100 years from now. People want to know about that. And I had an argument with Zinsmeister over who's going to go down to the PX and get some Milky Way bars. That was really great. So I started to keep a diary. I kept it for 4 days. And that diary, by the way, still exists. I have the diary that I kept for 4 days in the Army. And it is about 9 pages long, covers 4 days in my life in the Army. And how it happened to still exist is that it drifted down to the bottom of my barracks bag. And when all my stuff was shipped home, after all of it was over, among a lot of other stuff like petrified cookie butt ends, a lot of old pieces of busted equipment and junk, was my diary, which I still have. I occasionally read it over and cross myself and thank God that I'm out of all that. But the urge to keep a diary is I think disappearing. I mean, we do not have Boswells these days, and it just simply isn't a fact. And so as we mess around our lives and drool them away and drip them out the window and squeeze them through the washcloths of time and flush them down the drains of eternity. Oh, that was not bad. And as we do these things, we find ourselves, you know, just waiting. I don't know what it is. It's living. And a couple of weeks ago, I was messing around downtown and down in the village. And that's a great place. I'd say the village is the best place probably in the United States for just messing around and letting your life go down the drain. More than one guy has just done this for all of his life, just walking around. And in fact, I saw, you've seen him, Nick. I know one guy that has probably been going in and out of the coffee shops in the village quite probably since the end of World War One. Same guy, drifting in and out. He's got a giant white beard. And his life is spent just walking around. Once in a while stopping and looking through garbage cans for God knows what. And and only in the village can you get away with that kind of stuff. If you lived in an elegant community in Westchester County, can you imagine just walking around looking in garbage cans? You don't get a second glance in the village if you do that. If you have a gigantic beard and you have a red, white, and blue sandals on. That's one of the great things about the village. It is absolutely tolerant. And this is a rare quality in our world. And tolerance, of course, brings along with it a lot of other stuff, like doggy doo-doo and various other... This is, by the way, euphemism used by a lady who lives in the building next to me. I thought it was such a repulsive euphemism, I started to use it. So, nevertheless, the village has all these external ramifications of the ramshackle. And so I'm walking around down the village one day, and you'll find in the village almost anything in God's earth is on sale in the village if you look enough. Really true. Absolutely true. You'll concede that, Nick. I mean, new stuff, old stuff, all kinds of junk stuff, everything. In fact, they've got stores down there that sell nothing but the rotten old battered toys. Have you seen those stores? Oh, there's a store called Second Childhood down there. That is right. And they sell nothing but old toys to ex-kids. This is not for children. It's for another type. That's beyond the scope of tonight's lecture. But nevertheless, you've seen that place. Yeah, there's three or four of those joints. There's a place down there where they sell nothing. Nothing but old movie posters. That's it. There's a place where they sell old sheet music, not to be played, but just to sell. Okay? So that's the kind of place it is. And, of course, it adds a certain zest to life. So I'm walking down the street. I buy more great out-of-print books just by walking down through the village, and there's a guy sitting squatting on a stoop with a cardboard box with some paperbacks. And if you've ever done this, and you buy a book for 12 cents, you know. So I'm always doing this stuff, buying these great books and stuff. So I'm walking down the street, and there's a guy squatting there in a doorway, and he's got a couple of cardboard cartons with some old books and stuff in it. And I just walk past and automatically look at this stuff, and I come across this thing, and I said to him, how much is that? And he says, I don't know. He said, that belongs to Wally. And I said, belongs to Wally? He said, yeah, my partner. Can you imagine two guys with cardboard cartons on a stoop of some place that's a partnership yet? So he says, belongs to Wally. He says, well, how much is it? He says, you want to buy it? And I said, yeah. He says, oh, a dime. And I said, a dime? I said, that's pretty steep, man. And he said, well, if you want it, you want it. If you know it, the hell with you. I think that's a typical village dialogue, too. So I said, okay, so I give him the dime. Now, why I bought it, I'm not a collector of stuff, Nick. I wish I could get myself organized to have a $12 million stamp collection. You know, that's a collector. I don't collect artifacts. I collect junk. My life is surrounded by junk. And so I bought this thing, and I do not even collect old records. Here it is. You've got it on the turntable, Nick. It cost me 10 cents in the village. And I turned the machine on at 78, and I want to show you what I bought for 10 cents in the village. Hold it on there, Nick. And it even had it, had with it the folder. It was in like mint condition, see? And it came with the jacket, which was very different from the jackets of today. It says Columbia Record. It's a gray jacket. Columbia Graphinola Records. Did you know that was their original name? Columbia Graphinola Records. And they have a whole picture on the front of all various types of gramophones you can buy. You know, Columbia apparently made they didn't call them records. They called them like Victrola. But Victrola was a brand name. RCA Victor. Victrola stood for Victor. RCA Victor. Well, did you know that Columbia had its own name? Yes, Columbia, because they couldn't use the term Victrola. So they used their own term, and it was Graphinola. I obviously did not get popular. I've never heard of it. Hey, turn the Graphinola on. But here's the various types of Graphinola. For example, you can get every Columbia Graphinola is carefully constructed of high-grade materials by experienced and first-class workmen. Prices for standard models up to $300. Now, wait a minute, that was a long time ago. That was in the very early 20s. $300 must have been a heck of a whopping cut out of somebody's paycheck. And listen to this one. Period models up to $2,100. I had no idea you could get a wind-up phonograph record for $2,100. Well, what would one of those be costing today? I mean, if you got one of those in the collector's market. A period Graphinola, Columbia. It says, no matter what price Graphinola you buy, you may be sure that you are getting the best instrument of its class in the world. Now, here's a picture of one of their $2,100 models. It says, the Columbia Period Graphinola, French Provincial. Handmade case with its features of tone control and individual record ejector is the peer of all musical recording instruments. Its rich and brilliant tone has made it the universal favorite with music lovers everywhere. And that's the $2,100 model. And they have some great records on the back. It says a choice selection of Columbia records is available. And there's a little box that said, you should receive our monthly supplements as issued. Why don't you write for Graphinola Supplement? I think I'll write to Columbia and ask them to send me the Graphinola Supplement. You know, because they are free. We would be glad to send it to you. And here, before we go any further, it's fitting we'd be playing this here. This is WOR New York. Before we go any further, Nick, would you please give them a taste of what I bought for 10 cents from a guy who was working out of a cardboard Charmin tissues case on 4th Street, as a matter of fact, if you know where he was working. And his partner, Wally, probably blew a gasket when he found that I bought this for a miserable dime. Just bring it in there, Nick. Sneak it in. There it comes. Very nice. That's good. Georgia Rose. And I don't know what this mysterious notation means on the record, Nick. It says the Georgia Rose introducing Snowflake. Does Snowflake playing the trombone? There's no lyric on it. I have to assume Snowflake is playing something. Quack. By the way, has done many, many television series and still does top movies. He's not an ex-movie star. He is a movie star. I mean, of the first rank. And so I took one look at the name on the record label, and I realized that he was in this band. By the way, he plays in the weed section, if you're interested. Who was it? Furthermore, I'll give you another clue. It's a famous story. This particular band played they had vaudeville or something in those days, and he played on the stage. The band played New York City. They were traveling around the country, and they played New York City on the stage. And an agent sitting in the audience saw this guy playing in the band. Sit it back, Nick. Just sit it back. He saw this guy playing in the band and went backstage and asked him if he ever thought of being an actor. He just liked the way the guy looked. At which point, the guy laughed loudly and says, "Oh, come on, you're kidding," and went back to playing his horn. They continued to travel around the country. The band traveled, and as a traveler, traveled out to the West Coast. The band is again playing on the stage. This time, another guy pops up out of the audience and says, "Hey, have you ever tried to think of this idea of movies? Have you thought of making movies?" He says, "What do you mean? I played a saxophone." The guy says, there's nothing to this movie acting. You just walk around and they turn the crank and you make more money than you playing a saxophone. So he says, "Okay, that's fine." He's become, ever since that day, a top-ranked movie star. Who was it? He's in this band right here, playing in this band right now. As you're listening, it's worth a dime, isn't it? You agree? Snowflake is playing that lead horn there. Now, here comes the star. He's just in the section. Who is it? You don't know, and you think you're a movie buff, don't you? Bring it down, Nick, and turn it off, and then flip it over, and set it in the middle of the other side. In fact, you can give me the opening on that. So there's another little sidelight on this particular record, another little side issue of this thing that should be said. The guy only once, to my knowledge, did he play a musician in a movie. I'll give you another clue, and it was funny as heck. He was playing you see this movie very rarely. I happened to see it on late television one night, and I'd never even heard of it. It must have been made rather early in his career. In fact, it was made early in his career, and he was a musician in this particular one. And he formed a trio with a kid and an old man. The crazy idea that they had no money and they were trying to make some dough and they were broke and the whole thing, and the kid played a piccolo or some crazy instrument. This guy played the saxophone in the trio, and the old man I think he played the fiddle or something. Anyway, the point is that they were always running around in this restaurant, and their trio was playing away like mad. It was, and they would trill around among the customers playing their instruments, and he played in a strange way. And I'll give you one other clue to this guy. He had a television series which is now not on, as far as I know, just went off last season, but it's in reruns all over the country, big color TV series. And something was on that series that probably even the people who watched it didn't know. He played the theme on the saxophone for that TV series. He played it. He actually recorded the theme. It was never set on screen. They never gave him screen credit because he's carefully hidden the fact that he was a musician. But he did play the theme. And in fact, how I happen to know this, a friend of mine out in Hollywood involved in television production, we got talking about it one day. I says, that theme, that's a very curious style. And he says, "You're right. He recorded." Who was it? Now, I'm giving you more clues all the time. Who was it? Incidentally, an excellent actor. He does not play in musicals, which may surprise you. So if you think it's Dan Daly or something like that, you're wrong. He does not play in musicals. Almost all of his stuff is dramatic stuff, and he occasionally plays comedy. He's excellent in comedy, but he plays mostly, and he's a leading man. This is not a character actor. He's a romantic lead in most of the stuff. Who was it? I'll give you one more clue. It was not Cary Grant, although he's of that caliber. Nope. No, the man is alive and well. Gary Cooper is no longer with us. Nope, it was not Jimmy Stewart. Although Jimmy Stewart, there is another little story can be told about Jimmy Stewart. You know, I was involved with New Faces at one time, and I appeared in one of the versions of New Faces, you know, the Broadway Review. And Leonard Sillman tells the story about the time that Jimmy Stewart arrived to audition as a folk singer. Stewart, this was before, of course, he made it. And that was way back in the early days of Stewart's career, obviously. But the question that I'm asking you here, who is this guy? Now, you've got two guesses out. Now, who could it be? In fact, I'll tell you, I'll give you another clue. Now, you ready for another clue, Nick? Here's another clue. He looks like, just his face, just the way his face is and everything, he looks like he should be a saxophone in a jazzy college dance band orchestra. He's got that kind of... There you got it! Doesn't he have that look? Okay. All right. And I'm not going to pass it along to the listener type. You got it. You hit it. That was right. See, that was the clue you needed. His face has that look, doesn't it? and you want to hear another example of his playing? All right. You hear a little of him. You actually can hear him on this if you know his own individual style. Okay, Nick. This was one of their big production numbers. Very good, Nick. I have to compliment you. Are you surprised at it, Jerry? The answer? Very good. There you go. I love this riff here. Now here's this section. Do you remember the theme of his TV series? Very good. Excellent. That was a terrific dime's worth, I'll say. Oh, yeah. You can pick it up there, Nick, and you can see the name of the orchestra there. That was his crowd. That's right. Great group. And I'll bet he's got a copy of that record, as a matter of fact, because almost any guy that ever plays in a band that records undoubtedly gets copies of it, keeps them in his underneath all the other mementos and jazz. But that I picked that up one afternoon down in the village, walking around for a dime. And, you know, you can pick up all kinds of stuff. In fact, I picked up a book. I wish I had it now. I, like a fool, you know, if I get one letter a week, I get 20 letters a week from people saying I made a great mistake. I lent my copy of Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memories or In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash, to my cousin or some guy, and I never got it back again. I just wonder how many people, and I'm included, how many people have lent a book or something to somebody and have regretted it ever since, never got it back and have regretted it. I really do. There's one book that I picked up a copy of a book. It wasn't worth anything intrinsically. In other words, the money value is not much. I picked it up down on... You know, down on 4th Avenue. You ever go down to those bookstores down there, those fantastic places down on lower 4th Avenue? I like to go through the humor section and stuff and just see what's around. I found a book written by a major something, just a name I never heard of, just a name. And it was English. And it was had a yellow cover. And it showed a guy on the cover wearing knickers. It had a black drawing on the cover of this sort of leatherette yellow-covered book. It was a small book. It wasn't a full-size book. It was one of these smaller kind of books that they made a lot of back in those days. And this book was printed about 1903 or 4, something like that. It was an old book, but a useless book as far as book collectors are concerned, just a book. I bought it for about 15 cents. And it was the story of a guy, the reason I picked it up is humor, and it was about golf. It was about a guy who, it was a strange story. It was funny as hell. It was a guy who wanted to learn to play golf. And he was a retired colonel. And he was in Scotland. And remember, this is around the turn of the century that it was written, so this was long before the golf mystique that we have today. In those days, golf was played only by the elegant gentry or eccentric Scotchmen. So in this case, he went to learn to play golf, and the whole story involved him finally selling his soul to the devil. Now, that's what made it great. He could not play this game. How many of you have known the experience? He simply could not. I mean, he would try. He did well, but he was like shooting 99 or 100, 110, you know. And he was getting more angry. And he was, remember, he was an army officer, used to commanding men. And he could do anything he wanted to do. And he was a retired colonel of the Indian Army. And, I mean, he was a sahib. And so he was getting madder and madder. He went to even such an extent. He was so embarrassed that when he would go out to play golf, that he would hit these slices and he'd top them and all that he put dirt in his hotel room and he practiced hitting the golf ball in his hotel room so that he could do it on a secret method. So he absolutely no way. And the pro that he was going around with was this ancient Scotsman who kept laughing. Well, one afternoon, he was deep in a bunker. I will tell you the story. One afternoon, he was deep in a bunker. He had hit the ball into the bunker. And he's hacking away. He's hacking away down there, and he's getting madder and madder. And all of a sudden, he stood up. Now, remember, this is a distinguished man. He said, I'd give anything to learn to play this game. This game is the work of the devil. And suddenly, there was a pause.
puff of smoke,
and there appeared before him a gnarled old man carrying a bag of golf clubs. And he said, "Who are you?" And the old man said, "Did I hear you right? Did I hear you say that you would give anything to learn to play this game?"
He said, I'll learn to play this game, or I'll die trying."
At which point the old man said, "Do I take it then that you would give anything to learn to play the game?" And the colonel says,
"Anything, I said. I say what I mean."
At which point the old man said, "Even your soul?" At which point the colonel, being a very blasphemous type, said,
"What do you mean, my soul? I don't believe in all that stuff. I don't believe in souls. What do you mean, souls? I'd sell what soul I have, yes, to play this game. And I don't believe in souls for starters."
And the old man then said, "Oh, well, at that point, of course, since you do not believe in souls, you will not be signing away anything, will you? You sign this paper, then, and you will learn to play golf. I will teach you. And I'll guarantee I will teach you." With that, the old man reached down into his golf bag and took out a scroll of parchment that was covered with Latin inscriptions. And it appeared to be an ancient, ancient scroll of far long gone, the LP, far long gone days in the past. Ancient scroll. And he unrolled it in the sunlight of this Scottish moor golf club, an ancient and wonderful golfing club by the shore of the raging sea. An ancient course where men had been playing golf for hundreds of years. And the colonel says, "What do you want me to do with that?" And the old man said, "Hey, just sign here at the bottom." And the colonel whipped out his pen. With that, the old man says, No. "We must make this just a little more official. You must allow an old man his crotchets. Just sign in blood." The colonel said, "Blood? Are you mad, man?" "Yes, well, it's just one of my ancient crotchets. I'm too pleased." So the colonel says, "Of course." With that, he takes a safety pin and he pops up. Little hole in his finger, and he dips his pen in, and he signs his name in blood. And the old man said, "The deed is done. You'll be the finest golfer in the British Isles. You'll indeed win the British Open. I will guarantee you success. Strike the ball now and see." And the man swung at the gutta-percha ball, which he'd been swinging at for weeks, to no avail. And the ball rose. High it arched in the brilliant sunlight. 250, 275 yards, and rolled to within a of the cup. Other foursomes playing for miles around saw this magnificent bunker shot, and the colonel climbed out of the sand, walking straight and tall, sank his putt, and teed up his ball on the eighth hole. He looked down the fairway, 565 yards, two water hazards, seven bunkers, and a mean dog leg. He addressed the ball, and for some curious reason, he felt this electricity running through his body. All his muscles pivoted. Somehow everything was just right. He knew for the first time in his life that he was in tune with nature itself.
that he had contacted the infinite. And all was natural. All was rhythmic and unified. And he swung his club back on the backswing. And then his club moved forward and struck the gutta percha ball cleanly and hard with a soft, snicking click. That angry, snicking click of the professional drive. And the ball rose into the heavens. A thing of beauty. Sheer poetry of flight in motion. Straight as a die, it soared higher and higher. Its trajectory flattened out. As it moved to the right, neatly negotiating the dogleg while in flight. 400, 420, 495 feet. And then gracefully sank to earth and rolled to a stop 75 yards from a 500-foot hole. And the colonel strode down the fairway, took his number 9 iron, met one swing, laid it within 6 inches of the hole, sank the putt. It was the first eagle ever shot on the 8th hole. A percha ball. But that was only the beginning. That was only the beginning of the great story. The colonel played a round that afternoon that broke all existing course records. The next day, he again emerged on the links and again broke the course record. An unknown, unsung, aged gentleman, a retired colonel, had emerged as an unbelievably talented golfer. He shot 62s and 63s with casual ease. He began to be spoken of with hushed whispers among professional golfers around the British Isles. And then the afternoon of the British Open dawned, a hard driving rain. And in the rain, with a 40-mile-an-hour spanking crosswind, the colonel shot a 59. And then, halfway through the second round, as he was walking up to the ball, the tiny figure appeared again and said, "It's time now for me to collect. You have won your British Open. It's time for me now to collect your soul. Come with me." Book out to somebody like a damn fool, and I wanted to read it again. I have no idea where the book is, the name of it. If any of you know about that book, let me know. I'd love to have a battered old copy of it. And so as you walk around the village in your shuffling sandals, as you peer through the grimy windshield of life, as the white line whistles by under your 619/472 tires, and your life is being counted out by the moving telegraph poles of the New Jersey Turnpike, and the white line fever has gripped you deep in your soul, one is still left with the eternal question, and there are no answers.